The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
I'm Mike Consul.
And I'm Eric Hansel.
Welcome to Report from Europe. Our subject this month is one of my favorites. I was just talking to Merrick before we hit the record button. It's vertical farming. I'm really a fan of the whole indoor and vertical farming, urban farming, you name it, type of agriculture, because it just really addresses so many different issues that we're facing, everything from too much water use to pesticides to climate change and so on. Merrick, I think you agree, and you have written about it, or the magazine has. Did you actually author the story yourself?
No, I commissioned a freelancer, wrote it for me, a writer called Bennett Voiles, who's based in Germany. He wrote it, but
Right. That refreshes my memory now. In fact, I picked up a truncated version of the story for Real Assets Advisor magazine as well.
Yes.
So how did you get onto the subject? Talk about why now is vertical farming a subject to be written about?
Yeah, I think the first seed that was planted, to use a appropriate metaphor.
Very good.
Yes. that's straight off the top of my head as well, Mike. I wasn't planning that one, I promise.
That's the best kind.
Yeah. I think it was at our one of our VIP Europe conferences. So someone sort of mentioned the possibility of repurposing some stranded assets, distressed assets, you know, maybe in retail or other areas where they're not performing. And they sort of mentioned the possibility of, I think it was first described as kind of urban greenhouses or something along those lines. And then, you know, I did a bit of looking into it. I know you've covered it in the past as well, Mike. It's one of those asset classes where it's very much in its infancy, but it could go one of two ways, I guess, depending on what the appetite's like. But as you say, it ticks a lot of boxes in terms of not solving all the issues, but going some way to helping alleviate problems with transportation, carbon emissions, having produce much closer to your doorstep. And the use of water and pesticides and all that good stuff as well.
Those are a couple more points you just brought up that I didn't touch on, but are really important, because when you mentioned transportation and when you're close to market, which you can obviously do with urban farming or any kind of indoor farming, where you're close to market, you pick it when it's truly ripe and it's most nutritious, because it doesn't have to travel for weeks at a time. So it can go right to the table, right to the market, right to the table. And it also can get rid of what we call, here in the States, we call them food deserts, you're in the inner city and you can't get your hands on fresh fruits and vegetables. So one of the reasons a lot of urban Americans, especially poor urban Americans, have health problems is what they do get at the store are things like chips,
right?
And, what you call crisps and chips and crackers and what have you. Yeah. And that's a lot of calories that are useless calories and will put weight on you and will make you sick over time, like diabetes and so on.
Right, right. Yeah.
Anyway, I digressed slightly, but this is all about nutrition and sustenance and real estate usage. Because I'm also thinking in terms of, you know, we have office. If office space doesn't come back, you think of a 10-story building being a vertical farm. I don't know how doable that is, but you've got the glass, you've got the structure. Mm. I don't know what retrofitting costs and whatnot. We're not at that stage yet. I certainly don't see that anyway.
No.
So. Mm. What did the story have to say?
I mean, like you say, Mike, it's kind of endless possibilities. But I suppose if we look at some figures, then I think this is from a German Anyway, the research firm is called Grandview Research, and they were cited in the article, and they talked about the market reaching $3.89 billion in 2020. So, you know, not massive, 3.31 euros, I think that is. So, and they expect it to grow quite significantly, sort of by 20% through to 2028. That's what sort of their estimates were. I won't do the maths on that, but it's definitely growing. Obviously not a massive market, but I think in terms of real estate, like you say, it could create solutions for stranded assets, as I said before. And it's quite interesting that you sort of mention the impact on health and lower income families who don't eat as well, and perhaps, and this could be a way of them getting fresh produce. It also has, it's also been shown to have sort of a good social impact anyway, just having vertical farms. I think in the Urban Land Institute cited or pointed to some cities, some areas in the US such as Newark and Buffalo, which are large industrial areas, and they've managed to create quite a few jobs with these sort of urban farms. So there's that societal impact as well. It could be a big growth area for jobs as well.
Another point you just made is you mentioned Newark and Buffalo. They both have tough winters.
Right.
You can grow food year round indoors, which is not the case within farm fields. So that's another one.
Yeah.
And of course, creating these jobs. And I think the first line of real estate that probably would benefit from the growth of this would probably be industrial. There's a lot of warehouses, aging warehouses in cities like Newark, and no doubt in a lot of the older European cities, you've got a lot of aging warehouses that could be retrofitted and used for indoor farming. So far ahead of using something like an office building, because I could see a lot of other uses for an office building. A warehouse, though, it's almost naturally suited to something like indoor farming or vertical farming.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that chimes with a couple of, Bennett cited Cushman and Wakefield's and Savills, and they both sort of speculated that old manufacturing buildings could be used for farming, for urban farming, and also. And it could be positioned sort of in low cost locations near logistics hubs anyway. And we know that a lot of people move from logistics facilities and they have to be repurposed again for a different company or a different use, and that can be done. Definitely that definitely chimes with what he wrote about.
And we've seen that happen with the legalization of marijuana in some states here.
Right.
An example being Colorado, and they require that marijuana be grown indoors, that it not be in open fields where people can get their hands on it. It has to be grown indoors. And the vacancy rate among warehouses in Denver just plummeted down to basically zero. We've seen this happen to a small extent with the marijuana industry, and it certainly could happen to a much bigger extent when you're talking about the food supply and growing that way. But talk about vertical farming. I mean, there's indoor farming. Like, for instance, you can see a greenhouse, and they build greenhouses now that are as large as 20 acres. So, but those are generally just kind of, you know, one level of plants. What about vertical farming? What's the advantage? Is it a space issue? Is that what it's about?
Yeah. In Europe, it would be a space issue. Yes, absolutely. Obviously, you know, struggling for planning permission for all sorts of property types across many European cities these days. So there's a competition for space and a premium for the right sites. It would be a space issue. I think there's also been talk about sort of using subway tunnels, defunct sort of subway tunnels, but we didn't touch really upon that in the article.
So how would that work?
You'd have to have
a lot of artificial lighting then, a lot of energy.
Yeah, a lot of artificial lighting, a lot of energy. Yeah, so kind of underground farming, it's kind of called, isn't it? For example, in London, there are sort of old air raid shelters back from World War II, which aren't used, and some underground, some metro stations that aren't in use anymore could potentially be repurposed for that. But yeah, most of the focus, I think, is on above ground stuff that's above ground.
You guys do a lot of, you're big on renewables, and I suspect that, you know, a requirement could be made that find energy self-sufficiency, put in a solar array, put in wind, put in geothermal, whatever you need so that you're not depleting the electric grid or the overall supply, that you're additive, not subtractive.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. 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 I mean,
the sun works very well above ground anyway. Yes. So you could go with the greenhouses, but also I guess that's the case though with any kind of indoor farming. Though you are going to need artificial lighting because you're going to have winter months, and you're not going to have an entirely translucent facility unless you're building a greenhouse.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean there may be ways around it in the future, but you're right, Mike. Yeah, I mean going back to the vertical point. This wasn't actually mentioned in the article because this was announced, I think, early this month or late August. So, one manager, Aberdeen Standard Investments here in the UK, they worked with a company called Square Mile Farms, and they've installed a vertical farm at a multifamily housing scheme. I think it's multifamily, not single family. Yeah. In a suburb of London, in West London. They call it a hydroponic farm. So hydroponic just meaning, I think that just means that no soil is required, just kind of nutrient-rich water, which just recirculates around around the roots of all the plants. So it's a very efficient system and doesn't have to use as much water, which is one of the points we made at the beginning. But that's part of a residential tower. So not only do you have, a workspace and fitness facilities and, I don't know, whatever else they have, communal sort of areas to mingle with other residents, they also have their own herb and vegetable supply in this, or that's the idea anyway, within this one sort of tower block, which is a kind of multi-purpose, multi-use kind of situation.
A new component to mixed use development.
Yeah, yeah. And they use LED grow lights, I think they use. And but London's, I guess, same as Newark and Buffalo, you know, the winters can be quite bad sometimes. So I think that's one of the problems, isn't it? Using artificial light. That's kind of the cons, if you like.
Well, yeah. It is until, the thing is, there's no reason why a facility can't, I don't see why a facility wouldn't be able to create a renewable source of energy for its facility. I don't know that that's a requirement, but the idea, and maybe it's not even possible on site because it might be an urban setting, but it doesn't mean off site they can't be creating that and saying we're contributing this to the grid. We're replacing every kilowatt that we take. Off the grid. I mean, in an ideal world. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, this is the first I've seen. It was a Wall Street Journal article about the heat being so bad this summer that there were crops shriveling. And that's a really scary, really scary prospect. The idea that climate change gets so bad that the sun's so intense that crops are not that are being destroyed or cannot grow to the level necessary or the level that we traditionally, and the idea that we're going to move all that outdoor farming indoors is preposterous, at least in the short term. That would have to be a long-term problem to deal with, but that's a very scary prospect. And indoor farming would be the solution to that, but it couldn't possibly happen in the short term, unfortunately.
No, that's right. I mean, it's the cost as well. I mean, it's I think it's called Peter Tasgall, the Boston-based agricultural consultant that mentioned in the article, and they estimate that growing vegetables costs like $1 a pound or half a kilogram to grow conventionally. So how it's done at the moment, but they can be grown in a greenhouse for, I think, $2 $2.33, so almost €2. So that's a big jump. That's, you know, that's more than double.
So more than double? It costs more than double?
Yeah.
Wow.
But then in a vertical farm, they estimate that it would cost $3. So, you know, you're talking with three times the price. So that price obviously gets passed on to the consumer. So that's another hurdle that needs to be navigated. But these things always, it's like, maybe it's a bit like electrical cars. At the moment, they're very expensive, but you'd expect the price to eventually come down to a more affordable level for, you know, many families.
Or wind and solar electricity. I mean, wind and solar have plummeted.
Right, right.
So we're going to have to figure this one out too. But that's the nature of technological advancement and the advance of business. And so is this investable? Well, it is investable. Obviously, it's investable because somebody can start an urban farm. There's also what you were just talking about, Merrick, which is, hey, we've got these beautiful apples. It's only going to cost you three times as much as the farmer down the, you know, out in the fields there. I'm not sure, maybe you'd have to go strictly into wealthy communities, which can afford that. And there's some kind of advantage to it, such as we pick it very late in the process. They're very flavorful, sweet, flavorful, and nutritious sort of thing. I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that? Did your writer have anything to say about the nutritional component and the, you know, farm to table part of it?
Yeah, I mean, not particularly. I mean, he did make a point that there was a German research firm called, I'll mispronounce this, but it's Fraunhofer Society. And they estimated that one third of the food grown, so 1.3 billion tons globally, it never reaches the table, which I thought was astonishing. So I think that's mainly to do with produce that doesn't fit like a supermarket shelf's. It doesn't have the aesthetic appeal. So like the apple's a bit wonky, or like the stalk doesn't look right, or the banana's misshaped or something. So it just gets chucked or something. But they'd be able to, I suppose they'd be able to control what the fruit looks like or the vegetables look like a lot more, you know, with the technology they have now and the ability to do it within a vertical farm. But yeah, like you say, I think it would appeal to kind of hipsters or people who are prepared to pay more for organic food, that kind of clientele.
There are people out there for sure who will do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that. I mean, there's some here in the States, Whole Foods, they call it Whole Paycheck because it's so expensive. Now, I think the price has come down. Prices have come down somewhat since Amazon bought the company. But nonetheless, if you want premium stuff, there's plenty of people who are willing to pay a premium for something that they feel has been grown in a way that is socially responsible and is cleaner, that does not have pesticides baked into the growth process and so on and so forth. Same with meat. They don't want the antibiotics and the steroids and all that. Give me a pig or a cow that's been running around the fields and happily living and not taking drugs into the bloodstream.
That's right.
So it's a brave new world we're living in.
Absolutely. I think, I think the point about how it's the nutritional point and also the, you know, what we mentioned earlier about reducing travel time, and obviously by virtue of that, carbon emissions and what have you, there could be a case certainly in Europe for some governments or local authorities to look to subsidize some of these vertical farms and make them perhaps more affordable, whether that be the produce they sell or setting them up, a bit like how they did with solar panels in some countries. They made it, very affordable to set those up. So there could be something there where the government or the state steps in and gives the asset class. I'd call it an asset class, but it's quite small, isn't it? But gives the whole vertical farming sector a bit of a push from in that sense. There could be something there. It's very early days to talk about that, really.
Well, in Europe also is much bigger on the food, much better about food purity laws than the United States. I mean, right. What is in Germany, you make beer. If you're going to brew beer, you get, what, 3 or 4 ingredients, so that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
In the United States, it's kind of like, whatever you want to throw in there, that's fine. You want blueberries in there, go ahead. So those few for food purity laws, I would imagine, kind of lend themselves to this process, the indoor farming process, which is a much purer way to grow it, a cleaner way to grow it, and a much more controlled, climate-controlled, water-controlled, nutrition, and pesticide controlled and so on. At any rate, it's a growth area, and that's not a pun I thought about ahead of time. America, growth area for sure. Vertical and indoor farming in Europe, the United States, I think it's going to be all over the world, of course, but obviously the wealthy nations, as always, are going to be the ones who are the first to plunk the money down and start making it happen. So interesting story and interesting future there. We'll look forward to learning more about this as it develops down the road. Marek, thanks for the update as always, and we'll touch down with you again next month.
Good stuff, Mike. Good to chat as always. Thanks.